So an issue of war and this idea of the wasteland, and the wasteland in a way is the world where life stops or life is stagnant and growth cannot happen. It's a polarized world, a world where opposites do not come together. If we think of wastelands, you know, you can think of the deserts where there is no water. Or you think of the Arctic wastelands where there are plenty of water, but it's all frozen, there's no warmth. Because in a way, it's the conjunction of warmth, water, and ground creates, and the breath of life creates life. And life, therefore, is a cooperation between these different qualities. And as we know, when you have, you know, when these qualities of breath and warmth and water and ground come together, you create the most phenomenal gardens. You create food, you create flowers, you know, the great beauty emerges. But where these elements are not cooperating with each other, or either one is missing or one is overstressed, the ground is too stony, nothing grows. If the wind blows too strongly, the seedlings cannot root themselves, they are ripped out of the ground. If the water dries up, things die of parchness. If there's too much water, the ground is stagnant and nothing can grow. So one of the questions, really, when we encounter the wasteland, in some ways, is the impact. What is the impact on us of encountering these situations, encountering these places where life cannot flourish? What happens to us when we're in these situations? Talk in a moment about the First and Second World Wars, but if I think of war immediately, because just because of the 15-year association with Israel, that's normally the first place I go. I've been there many times, longer than I've worked there for 15 years. I've been associated with Israel for about 30 years. Been there a lot. I've been there for both intifadas. And there's something for me, and you, James, you were talking about, you know, the attraction towards the trauma or the violent, or there's something in me that is attracted to that. I wouldn't have hung around a country where this is, where a country in constant war. I mean, Israel has been in constant war as long as I've ever known it, you know, and Israel is one of those countries where there is never peace. And in a way, it sort of, you know, I come from a very, very disturbed family, really, and so that place of constant trauma and that war place, which is the place of friend and enemy, is deeply familiar to me. In my own family, the war was covert. It was disguised, you know, disguised behind smiles, and but the frozenness of the wasteland, or the fire of the wasteland, was at work most of the time. And I lived in very poor surroundings. Where the house I lived in was. Oddly, really, it's a bit like the one of the things you come across in the Grail stories is the wasted, ruined manor. My house was almost literally like that. You know, we had an earth floor in the kitchen, the outside toilet. It was a very grim place. So it was a grim and rather squalid place, and I lived with a quite a large extended family, so I didn't live with a nuclear family, but a family that hated each other. But looked on the surface, if you looked at my family from the outside, because everything happened behind closed doors, this would have looked like a very okay, up together family. But it was a family full of lies and deceit and people trying to kill each other in all kinds of ways, really. Occasionally, once or twice, even literally. So it is also a family with a lot of madness, a lot of schizophrenia and kind of and all, again, all kind of hidden. And actually the wider community was like that as well. I mean, there's part of South Wales I was brought up in. It's a mining community with tremendous poverty and depression and hatred, really. Hatred, you know, feuds that went back generations amongst families. Hatred of the English, you know, hatred of black people, hatred of Jews, a lot of enormous anti-Semitism in South Wales. Lots of jokes about Welsh Jews and how mean they are. I'm not Jewish, but you know, partly I have this very strong connection with the Kabbalah that somehow must come out of my soul root or something, because that's been, you know, started studying the Kabbalah when I was 14 in the strange little Welsh valley. So there's something about this whole area that speaks to me, this whole area issue of what happens to us as human beings when we grow up. What happened to me when I grew up around this was I completely split myself. I pushed it away. It's impossible to bear. It's partly when we look into war and the results of war, we go into a sort of hell. We go into the place where things are impossible to bear, and therefore you have to forget about them. You have to pretend that they do not exist. So you bury them deep. I had a very graphic experience of this once in Israel. I was in Israel during 9/11. When I'm in Israel, I teach very intensely. I don't have TVs, and so I'm not really in touch with the outside media. And I was walking along the street in a place called extraordinary street called Emek Raphaim, which means the Valley of the Ghosts. It was sort of appropriate given what was happening. And I was just looking at a TV. It was like a TV shop selling TVs. And I was looking at what I thought was a disaster movie, because of course I couldn't hear the kind of commentary, and it looked like, you know, planes are going into big. It looked like planes going into the two towers, and I think, oh, that's pretty clever. And I remember just looking, I think, oh, that's quite clever special effects. Then later I go into the shop, and a friend of mine tells me, who's American Jew, tells me, and I'm, you know, I go into a shock, can't quite believe it, and I'm in shock most of the night. The following day, I'm with the sitting there with my group, and I start crying because I'm so upset by what's happened. And my friends, the people who I'm teaching, who are really lovely people, they can't understand why I'm crying. And I say, well, look, hundreds of people have just died. It's very shocking. I'm very upset. And I realized, and they say, oh no, we live with this all the time. People die all the time. And it's that place where people disconnect themselves. So this is this massive world event. You know, I mean, it was, I was down in, later that night, I went down to the old city of Jerusalem, and there were people, there were quite a lot of Arabs celebrating the death of the Americans. And the thing that never ever got reported, there were a load of Arabs down by the Jaffa Gate lighting candles for the dead, and they were horrified by what happened. And in that sort of little vignette, you know, so some of my friends totally dissociated, they couldn't feel anything, and that's how they explained to me, that's how we have to live our lives. We can't feel this thing, we have to thicken ourselves. And I understand why they had to thicken themselves. I mean, because, you know, in those days, I mean, you know, one of the conversations I remember having with the guy who used to drive me to work that day was, should we take the fast route and risk the snipers, or should we just go the long way? And that's sort of the kind of, I mean, it's not like that now, it's the whole scene is much quieter, but in those days that's kind of what it was like. It's sort of, oh bloody hell, we're late, will the snipers be active today, what do we think, you know, and that's like an ordinary going to work kind of conversation. Or, you know, one of the things that used to happen to me is that, I'd get up one morning and discover that the restaurant I'd been in the night before wasn't there anymore because a bomb had gone off in it. And obviously I was doing everything I could to keep myself safe, and I did keep myself safe. I found even with me, you have to normalize that somehow. Otherwise you can't go there. If you're going to go there, and I was committed to go there, and I still am, you have to somehow do, well, okay, I'll keep myself as safe as I can, and I have to somehow live around this, and I can't feel the full impact of it all the time. And that's necessary, and there's a cost to that. And certainly, if you live in the war zones all the time, something in your feeling nature becomes thickened. Has to become thickened. The other thing you do is you polarize. And certainly it's been interesting for me looking at this whole Israel-Gaza, Israel-Palestinian thing. I get in quite a lot of trouble with people around here because I go and work in Israel. Because commonly people around Glastonbury, left-wing leaning people, regard Israelis as the devils and Palestinians as the saints in the conflict, and because I go and work in Israel, I clearly am supporting the devil state. And again, that's an understandable thing. It's what people do. It simplifies the situation, because if you're going to be with the reality of war, the reality of trauma and opposites, you have to hold a certain difficult tension if you're going to be present with it. Now, one of the things you can do is just push it into the background, and some partly you have to do that. But what you hope to be able to do, and this is the work I was doing with my group, is how do they, their problem is, you have to push it to the back of your mind, but you have to be able to remember it, in the sense of you have to bring that experience together in the presence, in the present, into presence. Now, if you can't do that, and very often people who have been traumatized can't do that, but they are then at the mercy of the unconscious trauma. And part of the work, the work I've done for many years in Israel, is how to help people. How do you keep your heart open in hell? Is the problem? Yes. Without the heart splintering into fragments, without the heart polarizing into friend and enemy. Now we need a lot of help in that, and in a way that's sort of the key issue really that we're going to be coming at from different angles at this weekend. And you know what I find that we need is we need contact. We need not to be alone, because the whole experience of that kind of traumatization takes you into a place of profound isolation. It takes you into the place of friend and enemy, where you gravitate towards the friend and push away the enemy. And you live then defending a split world. Whereas, you know, James making reference to alchemy is quite important, because in a way this work is an alchemical work. One of the key images around the alchemical work is the creation of the vessel that can hold the alchemical process, which is a process that some of the images used in alchemy sometimes are these processes, a very fiery image of calcination, of burning, or the sense of solutio, of dissolving, or say experiences of coagulation, or experiences of expansion. Now, what you find with the kind of trauma that affects human beings in this situation is that there's this act of forgetting and splitting and compression of experience that sits behind us, that sits in what Jung would have called the shadow, which profoundly influences our sense of ourselves and sense of the world that we live in, that pushes us from behind. And the whole thing, you know, it's interesting, the whole Israel thing, because of course it's intimately connected to what happens with the two world wars. You know, the whole, the process of the wars, the world wars. So the thing about war is constant in our planet, of course, but what happens around, and one of the reasons why it's important to look into this issue of the wars is that these are the world wars. They arise out of the experience of industrialization. World wars can't happen without industrialization. It's just not possible. You can't stretch it far enough. You can't get your troop. You need powerful machines, the fast machines that position your troops in particular ways. And in a way, what the whole process of the wars, in a sense, you see, comes out of that earlier process of that starts to begin in the 18th and 19th century in Europe, of the development of industrialization and technological advancement. Because it's that capacity in Western Europe that creates these machines that enables the colonial powers to dominate the world. And what we see happening is in 18th, 19th century is as a result of the development of ships in particular, and of machines of war, of effective guns, basically. You see the colonial powers dividing the world up between themselves. And in a way, and making deals with each other to support each other in the colonial adventuring. Now, what happens in the First World War, and it's the beginning, it's a very profound, very difficult poem, The Wasteland. Love it and I hate it. But he begins with this sentence that April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain. And he calls it the burial of the dead, but actually it's the uncovering of the dead in spring. It's the stirring of the buried roots. In terms of our subject, it's the, if you like, it's that warmth and water of spring that starts to water the deadened roots of these old deaths and traumas in us that mix memory and desire. It's a very beautiful phrase. And it's the desire for wholeness, the desire for health, the desire for life, really, that fed by the spring rains, that then rouses memory, that starts to uncover the dead. And then he immediately jumps to this a family scene about cousins staying at the Archduke's. Now we are immediately with the assassination of the Archduke in Sarajevo. We're immediately at the beginning of the First World War. And we're immediately with family, and we've got Marie, who's one of the member of the family, going sledding with that family. So he very cleverly brings us into a conjunction of the personal and the collective, and the family relationships that are based upon the colonial endeavours of the European world as it dominated the world. And the assassination in Sarajevo, of course, is the moment where things unravel and various deals are called upon. Austro-Hungarian Empire falls apart. It's extraordinary at the moment. I was in Hungary a couple of years ago, and these old dead things. Hungary there's a whole dialogue going on in Hungary about the betrayal of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the need for Austro-Hungary to rise again. It's the same kind of energy that happens around the Bosnian War, where old dead things come again. I remember once, many years ago, before the Bosnian War. It's part of the breakup of the Soviet Union. The BBC did a story on Radovan Karadzic. And the story was about, he was one of the leaders of the New Europe. This was the philosopher poet, the man who was going to a new leader in Eastern Europe, who was going to help the world find new healing. So it's very upbeat, you know, how marvellous, the evil empire is dead, the new democracies are coming, isn't this a wonderful thing? But one of the things I remember that sort of chilled me was watching Radovan Karadžić and his mates up a mountain singing old Serbian folk songs about how the white eagle of Serbia would rise again to drive out the Turk. And I had no idea what I was listening to, but something in it still does, something was chilling about that. Didn't know what I was hearing. And of course, literally, some little while later, that's what they did. That's what the Serbs in Bosnia did. They rose up, the White Eagle rose up, drove out and massacred the Turk, massacred the Bosnian Muslims. So there is something about, if we do not deal with these things, if we do not remember, if we do not allow the desire for life to revive memory, to bring it into the presence, these things repeat themselves. You see it happening all over Europe at the moment, with the rise of nationalisms, the rise of anti-Semitism is on the rise again, anti-Arab feeling is certainly on the rise. You've got the rise of UKIP in this country. I mean, not that UKIP is quite as bad as some of the other parties but there's still a shadow there. You've got the Golden Dawn movement in Greece. You know, you've got Marie Le Pen's party in France. There's something very kind of powerful and awful about this ancient dialogue of kill the stranger. The stranger is the threat. You know, the sort of moral panics of the current coalition government. The Romanians are coming, the Romanians are coming. You know, and there was just a beautiful irony where the BBC did a program about the Romanians coming, and this lovely bloke, I don't know if you saw this, they were at the moment, the day when the gates were open, right? There was a load of cameras waiting for the hordes of Romanians, right, to surge in, and so they kept asking people, "Is it Romanian?" And "No, British." And so they were hardly any. Finally, they got a Romanian, and they got this lovely bloke, really gentle man who had just come here, wanted to work and looking for work, and kind of and had such a sweet nature. And there was and they earlier in the week they did a follow up program on him, and he thought, what a wonderful country Britain must be. You have they have these welcoming parties for you, and people want to interview you about when your hopes for yourself. What an amazing friendly country it must be. So it was something just beautifully ironic and lovely about that, which sort of was a nice turning the tables on these lunatics who were, you know, imagining the hundred, you know, the sort of march, you know, the massed ranks of the Romanians. But this whole issue, I see, is both personally very important, that we bring out our own dead, that we discover, we revive, allow a desire for full life to revive the dead, to bring them present in our hearts so that in our personal lives we can make peace with them. Now the poem, The Wasteland, ends with this phrase, shanti, 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 peace, peace, peace. In a way, I mean, I will be making quite a lot of references to this poem over time because there's an enormous amount of stuff in there, but in a nutshell, there is this, it begins in this place of reviving the dead. It goes through all kinds of awful examples of the wasteland. It has this very powerful figure of Tiresias, the blind hermaphroditic seer, who is a central figure, and who's the figure who says this thing, sort of, what are the roots that clutch, son of man, you know only a heap of broken images where the sun beats. This is Tiresias speaking. Now Tiresias is a combination of opposites. He is the blind man who sees. He is both male and female. He is the seer who sees the dilemma of Oedipus, who understands the dilemma of Oedipus. And in some ways, this is the thing that Freud identifies in the 19th century, when he identifies the Oedipal complex as the root of much of human dysfunction, the desire to possess the mother, to kill the father, that war inside the heart, that war inside the family. Tiresias sees and understands this. Tiresias is also the figure who shows Odysseus the way home. He is the figure in the Odysseus has to go into the world of death. He has to go to the dead, and he has to find Tiresias, who shows him the way home to himself, the way home to wholeness. So within this poem of despair, there is actually the roots, the suggestion of the way home, that is by embracing, by making present, making ourselves present and our world present to the fragmentation and the heap of broken images. Now, around Glastonbury, much as I love the town, Elder Stephen, I live in Anthorpe James, there's a longing for a kind of fantasized past where the image is a whole, where there is where, you know, there's gods and goddesses and priests and priestesses and everything is lovely. Totally fantasy. It's never happened. But it's that there is a, but so that is not the way. The way isn't to try and retreat into the past and dress up as if you live in the past. You know, that this is the thing that Jung warned human beings about. If you're going to go into this territory, if you're going into the deep places, you must not be possessed by the archetypes. You must not try and live as if you are an archetype, as if you are a pure thing. The human being is a bridge between opposites. And the heap of broken images are brought to life. It's a very powerful piece in Jung's Red Book, where in his own attempt to work with the heap of broken images, what he has to do is to go inside himself to trust his own. Literally, what Jung did was to each day, at the end of the day, he would go to his study. He would sit at his desk. He's so Swiss Austrian. He wouldn't lie down. His way of relaxing is to sit at his desk. So Swiss, if you know Swiss people. I love Swiss people, but they're very formal. So relaxing will be, I'll just sit at my desk, not do anything instead of working. What more could one want? No need to lie down or anything, or anything kind of lax like that. Anyway, this is my prejudice against Swiss people speaking for a moment. But what he would do is to drop down, quite literally drop down inside himself, come into his senses, come into the interior, to imagine himself dropping down inside himself until he hit solid ground. And then he would literally trust his senses of the internal experience, explore the inner world, talk to whatever beings he encountered there, and listen to them. Now, even in his first experience of this, he experiences something quite remarkable in some ways, because he encounters these three figures. He encounters a woman, a blind woman called Salome. He encounters the prophet Elijah, and he encounters a black snake. And these slightly strange images are actually the fundamentals of all Jung's later teaching, because the Salome is the anima, the soul woman, the soul figure, who in him is blind and cannot see, because he is a very rational guy. He hasn't encountered her enough. He hasn't related to her enough. Elijah is the wild man, the wild prophet of an aspect of manhood, who the inspired but wild, who would be like Kidra in the Islamic tradition. He is in fact Kidra in the Islamic tradition. He is the wild green sort of prophetic figure that has insights that come out of the wilderness. And the black snake, of course, is this mysterious kind of shadow figure, who represents all the dark that has been swallowed, who is the tempter figure, who is the devil figure. Now, what happens to these figures eventually in Jung's world is that the Salome transforms as he works with her, eventually becoming Sophia, becoming the soul wisdom that guides him, that inspires him, that enables him to understand himself and the collective world around him. Elijah transforms to become Philemon, who is this extraordinary Gnostic teacher with the wings of a kingfisher, and who is the sort of archetypal magician, and connected actually through the kingfisher wings to the Grail myths, which we'll talk about in a bit. the black snake eventually becomes Agatha Daemon, becomes the good demon, the good inspiring figure, the snake, the shadow being that that when listened to and digested is a glorious being of light. Now, in order to do this work, this alchemical work, this synthesizing work, we have to do what he did. We have to trust our own inner worlds. And we have to work with the heap of broken images that we find inside ourselves. Because what he begins with, it doesn't look good. It's mad prophet Elijah, you know, who is, you know, sort of ranting and sort of and condemning everybody. So what he encounters in himself is this. He doesn't encounter Kedra, the guardian of the spring of life. He encounters the mad, raving prophet from the desert, condemning and judging him. The soul woman is blind Salome, the woman who has John the Baptist executed. It's tricky and sinister. A poisonous black serpent. Now that is his heap of broken images. And it sounds great because it's Jung, right? Because it's out there, and that sounds like, oh, well, you know, they sound a bit cool. But actually, his actual experience of that was disgust and horror. He didn't like it. And so what we encounter normally, often, when we go down into our own inner world, is we encounter these broken, distorted images, which, of course, we don't want anything to do with. We push away. We'd lift off. We kind of, you know, and actually the work, the crucial work, is to try and bear being with these things and bear coming into relationship with them. And then they guide us, they lead us on, they transform us, and they transform if we talk to them and come into relationship with them. Now, one of the crucial things that happens to him a little later on, as he works in a more collective level, he encounters a dying god. He encounters Izdubar. Now, Izdubar is actually Gilgamesh. He is the great hero figure of ancient Sumer. One of the old, in the myth of Gilgamesh, again quite related to the Grail stories, is the myth for the search for immortality, the search for the elixir that preserves you youthful and in touch with the spring of life forever. And the Gilgamesh story is interesting in his own right, because actually Gilgamesh never does find the he does actually find the leaves that will give him eternal life, but these leaves get stolen by a snake, and the snake eats the leaves, and the snake therefore ever afterwards has this capacity to shed its skin. It's a very subtle myth, because the search, and our search very often, is for some sense of permanence, some sense of eternal youthfulness, which, you know, we find reflected all the time in the world of advertising and in cosmetic surgery. There's the wish to remain almost as we were. And of course, if we follow that, we become a caricature of a fixed and broken image. Whereas actually in the Gilgamesh myth, you have to know you can never possess that quality. You have to go and be with the snake. If you want to become in touch with the spring of life, you have to hang out with the snake, and you have to learn from the snake the way to continually change your skin, to shed your skin, to continually die and be reborn. In fact, instead of avoiding death, you have to enter more deeply into death in order to find the unfailing spring of life. Now, what Jung encounters is this figure, Izdubar, Gilgamesh, who is dying in his vision, dying because of the rationality of the modern world, and who begs Jung to bring him back to life. Now, it's a crucial moment in Jung's exploration of the collective. Because what he could have done, and in German, Austro-German circles at that time, people were doing a lot of pagan stuff about bringing the old gods back to life. It has particular consequences around the Nazi movement, where they literally do this in a way, where the archetype of Wotan in a strange way is brought back to life. And so what part of Jung's temptation at this point would be to create a cult of Izdubar, to become the worshipper of Izdubar, to set up images of Izdubar in his home and worship him. And he realizes, because of his work on himself, that this is not the way. And that what he has to do to his Dabar is he has to shrink him, he has to make him small, through the power, or it's a small thing, it sounds very small, through the power of my active imagination, I must shrink the God. And it is through that human creative power, that very energy, that deep imagination within us, that in a sense gives birth to the gods. He has to own that capacity in his own heart. And what he has to do to Izdebar, to heal him, is to make him small, to make him human-sized. He puts him in an egg, and he puts him in his pocket to incubate him, so that he emerges as a new, as the energy of new life. So what you find happening, in fact, in Jung's work, he emerges as the green alchemical Christ eventually, right at the end of Jung's work, when he immerses himself in alchemy. And in a way, his approach to alchemy was, it is a, one of the methods that human beings developed, so soul alchemy at least, I don't know much about external alchemy, but certainly soul alchemy, is the way of taking the heap of broken images and putting them in your pocket and incubating them within the frame of your body and soul, and bringing then the deep energies that once were possessed by the external gods to life inside your own nature, which then commits you to the continual process of life and death, of living and dying, of living and dying, of living and dying. And this is a, you know, when we talk about these things, and we make all reference to the poems, you know, it sounds very complicated, but actually it's a simple, at its root, it's a simple process. But it is a difficult process, and the difficulty is not in the doing of it, the difficulty is in the trusting of it. Because of these ancient splits and ways we have learned to be ourselves, and the way in which we have used our imagination to create an image of ourselves and an image of the world. This work that you could say is the work of the Grail, is the work of the deep imagination that brings the opposites together, that brings the energies of life in connection with the energies of death, that brings together memory and desire, that stirs the dull roots, so that something new starts to emerge. And the method of doing it, which we will have a look at in a moment, is by just coming into our senses, coming into our bodies, and then trusting the internal experience. Now that's the hard bit. To take ourselves seriously enough, so that we do not dismiss the broken images who peep out at us. Not to psychologize them, not to analyze them, but to be with them, to talk to them and to listen to them is the hard bit. And to persist in it is the even harder bit. In a way, what Jung's work comes out of this daily discipline of sitting down. The end of the day, you know, he sees his clients, he has dinner with his family. Lots of times he will not have wanted to do this, he'd be tired. He ran a busy clinic, he very active in the world, he had a big family, he had a complicated, hellishly complicated personal life. You know, mistresses and all kinds of things going on. This is a man with it. So he had a lot going on. But the one thing that he did each time for this whole period, didn't do it all his life, but he did it for some years, and it was to sit at his desk and then to let himself drop down into the inner place and then explore the heaps of broken images and let them talk back. In a moment we'll have a break. I'll just stop this and see if there's any questions or thoughts.